Hey friends, I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available weekdays on CBC Listen.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
The discovery of remains on the grounds of the former residential school in Kamloops, BC, has forced the country again to face this issue of residential schools and ask some tough questions about whether we've dealt with this shocking part of our history.
And this might be shocking to some Canadians, but not really to Indigenous people whose family histories are tragically linked to this part of our history.
So much to get into with this story, so let's start. Okay, before we dive in, let's just start with what we know so far. So, late last week on Thursday, this story broke that the Tkamloops Dishkwapmuk First Nation in BC announced that they found potential remains, possibly as many as 215 remains, in this undocumented burial site on the grounds of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School. And that figure that we have, that 215 remains, it comes from a specialist in ground-penetrating radar. But it's a preliminary finding, and the actual report from that specialist will arrive in mid-June, so that number could be revised. It could be fewer than 215, could be higher. We don't know yet, but that is information that we have on hand. And I think it's fair to say that the reaction in the country has been of shock, grief, horror. There's been a lot of images of vigils and memorials across the country. We've seen people who are laying out baby shoes. And I think people who have not engaged with Canada's history of residential schools seem to be at least engaging with this story. Like it's kind of penetrated to that level. And we've seen the federal government under a lot of pressure for its progress on the calls to action on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That's, of course, the commission that spent years investigating residential schools and then returned with 94 specific calls to action on what to do to move forward. And in some provinces, Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, there's been this new push for finding more of these undocumented burial sites. And I have to say, Rosie, I appreciated you turning me around during our editorial meeting earlier this week, where we were talking about all the reactions we were seeing to this story and how so many people were surprised, because you said something that stuck with me, which is that it makes sense that people would be horrified, but it doesn't really add up that they'd be surprised. And I kind of spent all week thinking about that, about the politics of surprise, about like who gets to be surprised, because like you're right, like one of the most consistent threads through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission testimonies is that survivors quite frequently mention that there are burial sites around their residential school buildings. This is not new information. This is something that we knew. And I thought that might be a useful place to start, because for some folks listening to the story, like this might be a big culmination of all the horrors they've been hearing about residential schools. But I think if you're paying attention, then you know that not only was this likely going to come, but it may well be the start of a process that we just now have to start to go through.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not that you can't be shocked and horrified. It's only that you maybe need to ask the question about why you are, and whether that speaks to a need for this country to better educate itself about this issue. Before we go any further, too, we just want to acknowledge that some of what we're going to talk about may be hard. It may be distressing. Mm-hmm. It may be personally difficult to hear because of connections you may have. So we'll give you a number at the end where if you can turn to if you need to talk through some of this stuff. And we recognize that, but we want to have the conversation because it's an important part of our history. And so we don't do it alone. And because we don't do it with lacking the expertise in the issue, we're going to bring in our colleague, a CBC radio host, Duncan McHugh, who has covered the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for an awfully long time and done a lot of work on these stories and how we got to this point. Duncan, thanks for coming on and joining us today.
Rosie, Elamine, good to be here.
So let's maybe start at that point, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which you covered in depth. What do you say to those who might be surprised at the revelations of this week and who maybe have that missing piece of knowledge in their own personal education?
Yeah, my hearts go out to the people in Tkamloops and all. There are many First Nations in British Columbia who sent children to the Tkamloops and Indian Residential School. So my heart goes out to them. But I'll say this, like, surprise was the last thing that came into my mind this news was revealed. I did a lot of reporting in British Columbia. I've spoken with survivors of residential schools at Lajac in northern BC, at Port Alberni Indian Residential School on the island, at Tkamloops, at the Mission School in the Fraser Valley. And every survivor that I've ever talked to has talked about deaths in the schools, that children died, that they knew of children who did not come home. So we've known this for a long time from the words of survivors themselves, that their children were dying at the schools, mm-hmm. and it's been well recorded. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission itself, it was a major goal of the commission to try to answer some of those questions for a couple of different reasons. One, when they were actually trying to figure out how to set up the TRC, what they were looking at was, unprecedented to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in a first world country, right? Mm. I mean, most truce commissions, the models they had were in places like El Salvador and Argentina and Chile, mm-hmm. where they were looking at human rights violations and missing persons, and that was the purpose of a truth commission. So deaths and missing persons were very much in the DNA of what the TRC, the Canada's TRC, was trying to get to the bottom of right at the beginning. And they released, volume 4 of the, mm-hmm. of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report is all about missing children and unmarked burials. I mean, there were a couple hundred pages that the TRC dedicated to trying to answer some of the really basic questions that, as the TRC concluded, Canada has never answered, which is, who died at the schools? Why did they die? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where are they buried? And they began to start to figure out some of that information, but the conclusion was that, those they could determine from the records that they had that there were over 3,000 deaths, but there were many, many more. That number is much higher. And their conclusion was that Canada has never addressed those deaths and tried to kind of comprehensively answer, the questions, those basic questions: who died, why, and where are they buried?
And just to put some framing around what the schools were doing, they operated by the government and by various churches in the country for, I think, 100-150 years, Duncan, and the goal was to separate children from their families and to destroy their culture. I don't think there's another way to say it. To break family bonds, and
to kill the Indian in the child. Right. That was the express purpose. Right. That was, that the express purpose of the schools was to kill the Indian in the child.
And when I went back and read that chapter you're talking about, which it's hard to read, but important to read. One of the things that struck me was that even as the schools were happening, there were a number of times when people knew that the death rates were rising quickly, that children were being neglected, malnourished, getting ill very quickly. And yet they continued, and they continued for an awfully long time. That to me seems hard to reconcile too, that people would knowingly, that they would know that children were going there and that they were going to be harmed and that they could very well end up dead.
And there's the question is why did they continue when that was well documented? that as you say, that the children were getting ill, were malnourished. That's a complicated question that Canada has to answer for in terms of its history. But it is important to recognize from you know, in many ways, these were money-making operations for the churches, you know. And although the children didn't see the influx of cash that the federal government was shifting to the churches, that perhaps explains some of the reasons why they continued on for as long as they did.
So one of the things that we keep talking about this week is that when the Prime Minister is being asked about this, he says that 80% of the calls to action from that Truth and Reconciliation Commission are now completed or underway. And I think like a simple fact check on that is that that is just like a really simplified version. The truth is way more complicated because CBC's been tracking the progress of those calls to action. And out of 94 calls to action, 10 are complete. There are 10 that are they can say that are done. If you want to include the in-progress calls to action with progress specifically underway, that takes you up to 34, which leaves 60. Out of those 60, you know, there's 38 that are under a category that CBC's calling in-progress with projects proposed. And one big one of that category is, you know, reduce the number of Aboriginal children in care. But when we think about the specific calls to action that are specifically focusing on missing children and burial information, those exist. Those are recommendations 71 to 76. How central do you think those were, Duncan, to the overall reconciliation journey?
They were, I mean, all 94 calls were important. And if your listeners are wanting to understand better, you know, where the federal government is at, I would recommend they look at Beyond 94. You can just Google that. And that is a project by CBC Indigenous, which is ongoing, tracking mm-hmm. the implementation of the 94 calls to action. And the reason that CBC Indigenous started that project is because the Prime Minister has repeatedly said that implementing, accepting and implementing all 94 calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a goal that he committed to from when it was released. And he has repeated that over and over again as Prime Minister. Your question, Al-Amin, about the calls to action with regard to the grave sites and burials, yes, they were incredibly important, and yes, the federal government has committed money in its budget to the National Residential School Student Death Register, but work on that seems to be going incredibly slowly. And so, you know, at a couple of different junctures, the head of the National Truth and Center for Truth and Reconciliation has gone to parliamentary committees and said we need to get moving on this in terms of creating you know, markers for identifying where the graves are, you know, having markers to observe where they are, in some cases having reburials. We need to have maps, you know. We need to maintain the sites, protect them, and that work has yet to be undertaken in a substantial way.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that the government, when faced with those questions this week, said a couple things. First of all, that some of those calls to action obviously are shared jurisdiction, so you can understand that. But it also said that it has given in the 2019 budget more than $33 million to help come up with that registry that you talked about there, Duncan, and that some of that money can also be used for these kinds of projects if communities want them. And we should make that point too. Not every First Nations community wants to do this. And when the TRC was doing its investigation, they made visits to cemeteries, grave sites. They looked at satellite imagery, and then they went to the government, the Stephen Harper's government at the time, and said, we would like more money to go and look at this stuff. And they were denied. So, I mean, they wanted to do that work early on and were stymied. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like we're really behind the eight ball now. And I wonder how important you think that is to Canadians' understanding of this part of the story.
I think you started off, Felamine, talking about how this has struck a chord for Canadians. And I'm struck by how many places across the country this week where people have been putting down small shoes. You know, I was at the statue for Egerton Ryerson at Ryerson University yesterday, and there is a growing number of children's shoes around the base of that statue. Egerton Ryerson is often said to be one of the architects of the residential school system in Ontario. And I think that those symbolic actions that Canadians have been taking right across the country tell me that you know, there's something about the discovery of this particular burial at Tecumloops which has struck a chord, because it is, Canadians are understanding that these were children. You know, these were children that were taken away from their families and from their parents and their communities, and in many cases didn't come home, and that seems to have resonated.
When I think about the amount of money that was asked for, Rosie, that number was $1.5 million that it was asked for way back in 2009, and it was denied. But was interesting about that time was that this was about a year after Stephen Harper made that historic apology to residential school survivors in the House. And that was an emotionally resonant moment. There were a lot of tears in the House that day. So then to have the story be that a year later, the government said, no, you can't have this like really negligible amount of money to look for these unmarked burial sites. It doesn't cohere with that apology that we think about. And maybe that's a metaphor, I guess, for the willingness that the Canadian governments of all political stripes have in terms of engaging in the symbolics of this, but not the reality of it.
And I'm going to jump in, Elamine, just because I think one of the things that Murray Sinclair, the chair of the TRC, former senator, has said, and all of the commissioners said last winter when they were marking the fifth anniversary, was that actions speak louder than words. And I think that's some of the concern about the rate of implementation of the 94 calls to action. And so when you see that nearly half of the calls to action haven't been acted upon, when you see that the federal government, for example, continued to be to go to court with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission over access to residential school records, literally went to court fighting the TRC and in its attempts and efforts to get access to, whether it was, you know, statistical reports on the residential school claims or whether it was records at the St. Anne's Residential School in Northern Ontario, the apology and some of the symbolic actions that have been taken are well received, but there's a gap between the actions and the words still.
We're just going to pause here for a minute, but we'll be right back with our friend and colleague, Duncan McHugh.
Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So I know you have more thoughts that you want to share, Duncan, about some of your experience, but I just wanted to ask both of you a really basic question, and Duncan and I are close to the same age. Elamine's the young guy on the pod. Did anyone learn any of this, like in social studies class or history class? Did this ever, when you were a kid, come up? Did, I don't know, junior high, did this ever?
Okay, I mean, like, it came up as sort of like, it was like one long sentence, and it was a long sentence that included residential schools, the Japanese internment camps and the Chinese head tax. And that was it. Like, that was sort of like, it was sort of like this very brief whirlwind through, hey, we've also had these bad parts. This was in high school. And I should say that, like, it got more in depth in university, but it didn't get more in depth in university through the curriculum of the classes I was taking. It was more through the people around me who were like, you got to know about this history. So it was never a formal part of my education. No, it did not come up in any kind of meaningful way, I would say.
So, that's better than what I got. There was no mention in my elementary, secondary school. And I'm gonna share how complicated this is. My great grandmother attended residential school, and I didn't know that until after she passed. I still don't know much about how long she was there, what she experienced. She didn't talk about it, and I knew nothing about it until after her death. So that's how complicated, how hidden this has been, how difficult it has been for our communities to try to speak about for so long now. And it's why, you know, when I attended the national event of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Vancouver, which was a 4-day truth gathering exercise, to see hundreds and hundreds of survivors coming and sharing their stories, often with their families, you know, the emotion of those 4 days was just so palpable, because so many families were hearing these stories for the first time, and so difficult to hear, but so necessary as part of the truth gathering process.
Yeah, I didn't learn anything either. I grew up in Manitoba, where you learned a lot of different things about First Nations, but you didn't hear this, not ever. And that, to me, I don't know how it's being taught now across the country, but that, to me is worrisome.
I'll tell you, the journalism students that I have now say that they did, you know, they're in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. They say they did learn more in high school. And there were thousands and thousands of high school students at these national events during the Truth and Reconciliation mm-hmm. Commission. And I think that was part of the goal, is, you know, as Murray Sinclair often said, you know, it was education that got us into this mess, and it's education that's going to get us out. And so I do think that that there are teachers right across the country who are doing making efforts to try to include this in the curriculum now.
So it's been several years, Duncan, since you started covering all this stuff. It does feel like maybe this week did give some urgency to these calls to action, but I wonder if they'll be sustained, that urgency, and why it wasn't there before, you know.
It's hard. I mean, the anybody who wants to know about residential schools in this country, they can find out. There is plenty of, you know, there are children's stories, there are records, the Truth and Reconciliation report is voluminous. If you want to learn the history, it's there. Do Canadians want to? That's an important question. Why isn't there the urgency? If I could, Elamine and Rosie, I just wanted to do an exercise with you that I saw Murray Sinclair do with a group once, and it might explain it a little bit.
Okay.
Do you guys have phones there?
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. So pull up your phone. Right. And find, go to your pictures file and see, and I'll ask our listeners to do this as well. If you're sitting at home, you know, pull up your phone and see if there are pictures of any pictures of children on your phone right now.
Not a problem. Not a problem.
Okay. Yeah. So Rosie's got photos. One, and while Elamine's looking, Rosie, just the first picture of a child on your phone. Describe the child.
A kid, curly hair, freckles, lying with his dog.
Oh, so cute with the dog. Okay, and Elamine, have you got a child on your phone there?
I do. It's my daughter, and she's getting ready for soccer. And so she's in her little soccer outfit with her shoes, just ready to kick a ball really hard.
Ah, so cute with getting ready to kick the ball. Okay, yes. So I want you to look at those two children, And I want you to delete every single photo of them off your phone.
Ugh.
Delete them all right now.
That is all the photos.
Yeah.
So that's what First Nations had to deal with when the children went away to the schools and didn't come home. And I think that a lot of Canadians don't necessarily make that connection to their own lives when they see First Nations people stand up and say, we want memorials to our children. We want to preserve the cemeteries. We want to know where they're buried. And we want Canadians to continue to remember those children that passed away. You know, you asked about the urgency. I think if Canadians understood that they had to delete all those pictures of those children on their phones, that maybe they might understand a little better why it is that First Nations people are putting such, and Inuit and Métis are asking for these commemorations, these memorials, to be taken seriously.
That was really hard, Duncan.
Yeah.
And full credit to Murray Sinclair for yeah. that. And mm-hmm. and I when I watched him do that exercise with a group of people, it broke my heart, frankly.
Yeah.
I don't want to delete those photos on my phone, and I don't think Canadians do either.
Hey, thank you for thanks for coming on.
Miigwech, yeah. Thank you very much yeah. for having me. It's an important story.
Yeah, we thanks appreciate for this, it. And if you've been listening and you're having a hard time, we do want to let you know that the National Indian Residential School Crisis Line has been set up to provide support for former students and those affected. And that number you can access 24 hours. It's 1-866-925-4419. 1-866-925-4419. So normally this is where we do our last call, and we do still want to do it this week, even though that was a lot to listen to and to take in. Mm-hmm. So we want to ask you how you think this country's doing on the path to reconciliation. That's a big question, but I'm sure you have some thoughts after this week. So tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is Party Lines. And let us know what you think. Of course, it is a big question. If you need to, you know, tweet a thread at us, we'd love to hear it. I think just anything to process this out loud is probably a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. That's it for Party Lines this week. From CBC News and CBC Podcasts, I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. I'm a culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
See you back here next week.
See you next week, friend.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.